Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Good tidings, dear listeners, and welcome to the latest edition of Credit Crunch, part of the FIC Focus podcast series where we focus on all things credit. I'm your host, Noel Hebert, and joining me is colleague Sam Geyer. Before diving in, a little public service announcement. Your support is, of course, instrumental to our ability to keep bringing great guests and great content to you. So if you haven't already, please do take a moment to follow, rate, and share. With that, let's go ahead and dive right in. Today's conversation, I'm actually quite excited for this one. It's poised to be pretty wide-ranging as we welcome Dan Zwirn. Dan is CIO, CEO, co-founder, and all kinds of other things over at Arena Investors. He's had a really fascinating professional history prior to co-founding Arena. And while Arena's platform is a kind of a go-anywhere, do-anything kind of special situation setup, I think that's going to lend to a really interesting day of conversation here. So Dan, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you doing it.
So before maybe getting into specifics, maybe let's start with you and your background a little bit. Harvard MBA, Wharton degree in economics, stops at some interesting places like one I don't see a lot, like MSD, Davidson Kempner, haven't seen that one in a while. So maybe talk to us a little bit about your professional journey, where you got to, where you are now, or how you got there, and sort of what ultimately led to you making that decision to hang your own shingle.
Sure. Well, I was fascinated by kind of finance and the history of finance from my time as an undergrad. And I also did a degree in computer science while there, and found that that wasn't as fascinating to me, at least. Having grown up in a place where there was no kind of connection to Wall Street or finance or anything like that, going to Wharton was, an eye opener in terms of thinking about what the possibilities might be. And there were all kinds of opportunities to have, smart people talk to you, whether it was upperclassmen or professors or people on the street. And I read everything I could and talked to anyone who would talk to me. And ultimately, kind of found my way to thinking about being an investor, and started out in that era. Certainly, it was particularly difficult to get an immediate investing job, but I ended up going to media mergers at Lazard Frere, which is an exciting time and the kind of Paramount Viacom era, and got a lot of learning there, both in kind of the technical skills around corporate finance, as well as just how to be kind of a grown up professional, and how not to be. And then went into private equity in the media area also with a firm called Madison Dearborn Partners, which, at the time was focusing on things like cellular and rural local exchange carriers and, various forms of, cable and broadcasting and everything else like that. So that was very interesting. And while there, realized that, the private equity firms at the time were largely, driven by, a couple of decisions a year. And as I began to think about what would make an optimal Buffett-style moated franchise of an investment business, having a few very smart people make a couple smart decisions a year, wasn't necessarily going to lead to the creation of intangible value. That said, if you made those great decisions like they did, and they were great at it, you certainly can get very wealthy, but it wouldn't be through the valuation of your enterprise. And at the time, there were firms like Hicks Muse and Carlyle and Texas Pacific Group and KKR that were starting to think of themselves, and Blackstone, of course, think of themselves as, broader based investment firms, and clearly had realized that their core competence beyond investing was serving as a financial steward in the alternative space to large scale allocators. And so I basically thought about, the different structures for that, and kind of wrote a plan to be what I referred to as a global chaser of illiquidity, having recognized that there were two kind of approaches one could take to being a broader based investment franchise. One was a kind of fidelity of alternatives approach, where that largely has become the way of the winners, so to speak, where you were basically providing branded beta or private asset ETFs that gave people comfort that you can't go wrong with buying IBM. The alternative, which I preferred and kind of fit my, who I wanted to be as an investor, was more what I refer to as a global chaser of illiquidity. And I looked at the history of merchant capitalism going back to, the modern era of starting in kind of 1600s in Amsterdam, and saw companies like the global grain traders and the European merchant houses and the Asian Hongs. And what I saw in common was that they weren't kind of, specializing in the particular selection of a security or an asset, but rather creating the circumstance by which kind of vastly disproportionate return for unit risk would happen by looking at value chains and finding the kind of choke points in those. And so that seemed a lot more appealing to me and something that could be, put together and create a repeatable franchise. And so from there, it struck me that the event-driven hedge fund space was a good place to express this thesis because, first and foremost, it had been the first and in some ways the and certainly the earliest place within the alternative space whereby the investment mandate of the GP could move around, right? And so instead of this, I'll do, Latin American corporate private equity with EBITDA between $10 and $50 million, micro slots. It was, let's go make money in whatever way makes sense. And most importantly, let's avoid the risk that is the has been the downfall of financial institutions throughout history, which is moral hazard. All right. And so, at first blush, when people think about a very wide mandate, they think, my goodness, someone could go do something crazy, right? And in fact, what's crazy is to do things that don't make sense when they don't make sense. And the incentive to that is presented to GPs focusing on areas that are only that may not be interesting is to deploy and then kind of ask questions later. And so I didn't want to be exposed to that. And the reality is that every permutation of industry, product, and geography that we look at is only episodically of interest, right? Because by definition, the way markets work based on kind of the nature of the human mammal, right? And so there's an intrinsic pursuit of alpha or pursuit of opportunity that ultimately gets crowded and then overcrowded and then blows up and then becomes compelling again and so forth. And that is the way every permutation of energy product geography has ever been in the financial markets. And so we wanted to put ourselves in a position to do the things that did make sense and avoid those the things that didn't.
Yeah, I mean that's a really, a fascinating approach, and not one you sort of come across very often. I guess, one of the things that strikes me, not least of which, is you talked a little bit or alluded to some of the sort of the winners in the PE space, et cetera. In some of that directed or narrow sort of investment strategy, I guess when you're sort of covering a lot of fronts, what do you need? And I guess maybe this gets into a little bit in terms of how Arena is structured in terms of maybe team size and that sort of thing. How many different kinds of skill sets do you really need to execute efficiently on that? Or do you find that there's a core set that's really fungible across these different strategies, and then you just really need to backfill with maybe some specialization here or there?
Well, that goes to the other two pillars upon which we based our business in addition to a free-flowing mandate, and that is the our sourcing structure and our servicing. And so it is true that in each of these permutations, expertise is required. There's a lot of idiosyncrasy in every single one of them. The question is, how do I get access to that capability when it does make sense, and not be burdened by the need to feed the beast when it doesn't? And so we took a page out of the book of the internal proprietary groups of the investment banks before the GFC, which was to really delineate who's an employee versus who's a partner of some sort. And the reality is the employees of your business should have a kind of slightly wider kind of set of capabilities that are monetizable throughout a cycle and be organized, in my view, in kind of pockets or business units, as we call them, that are kind of mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive, and allow a broad swath of opportunities to be pursued without endangering our investors or our firm by virtue of the kind of buckets or business units being defined in ways that press people or corner people into doing things that don't make sense. And then to supplement that, those business units with much more particularly focused folks who have very specific sourcing, analytical, or servicing capabilities to which we would want variable cost efficient, hyper-aligned access and attaching those to a given business unit. And so what that means is that we get the milk of the domain capability without the cow of the fixed cost infrastructure or the misalignment of incentives. And so when we're asked, well, you know, about our mandate, a frequent question is, well, how do you know what my micro expert in European shipping mezzanine loans knows? And the answer is, well, the answer is because we might have such a partner who has 40 years of investing in Hamburg shipping, who's putting a quarter of his net worth on the line every time we do something. And so not only is that equal, it's actually far superior to having someone manage a fund that only has to do a thing and becomes a hammer that only sees nails and effectively endangers the capital of the investors. And then finally, just to finish it out, servicing is very important too, because there's a lot of complexity associated with these things. And we are effectively what banks used to be, right? And so we have an enormous amount of machinery, and that's really a combination of people, process, and IT. We've been developing enterprise software that kind of governs all of this since 2004. So a little bit, some handiness in terms of my computer science background, at least that I kind of structurally have a sense of the design of it, though I certainly couldn't write the code for it. Again, we took a page out of the book of many of the distressed real estate firms that arose out of the S&L crisis in the early 90s in the United States, like a Lone Star with their Hudson advisors, as an example, where they had people sitting between the front and the back office, providing operational leverage to both, with a completely dispassionate second pair of eyes on every investment we make, so that our investing folks don't succumb to Stockholm syndrome and, again, endanger our investors. So that's how we do it.
Interesting. So I guess maybe one of the follow-ons I do have about sort of the partnership thing, because you sort of alluded to in your anecdote of, you know, a shipper in Hamburg with, you know, tremendous experience and a fair amount of their personal net worth on the line. So I guess the question comes out, are you looking for or do you discriminate between sort of investor-oriented partners, or are you looking for more people that have a specific expertise in addition to the investment aspect, or do you prefer one over the other at all?
Well, I think it's really a very particular kind of industrial, geographic, or kind of product capability, and it really depends on the nature of the investments. A lot of investments are all about the sourcing, right? And so it's not like you need a deep level of expertise to know that, for instance, I can buy, three airplane engines and four airframes and sell my basis out of them before I even execute the transaction and create free upside, right? It's not a blindingly difficult analytical exercise. However, having the relationships necessary to put that together is a major thing, right? And so it really depends on the nature of the assets that we're pursuing and thinking about what the particular expertise that is applicable that we might look for is.
And I definitely want to sort of pull in that thread of sourcing in a moment, but I guess maybe before we get to that, I guess maybe walk us through, I guess we already talked through what special situations means, but I guess maybe how do you think about in terms of how do you actually deploy the strategy at Arena in terms of what size checks are you looking to write in terms of, you know, what kind of due diligence process that you're running in terms of being able to pull deals together? I know you're very geographically diverse as well. So I guess maybe how do you put together the whole portfolio, I guess?
Sure. Well, I would start with the fact that the definition of, you know, how people think about special situations has evolved over time. And you know, there were strategies 25 years ago that seemed pretty special, that seemed pretty generic now, right? And so there's this continuous evolution that happens as we find our way into, you know, other stuff. However, we encounter people in the market who kind of derive great derive great psychic satisfaction from kind of complexity. From our perspective, if we could just make the easiest money possible in a super simple way that wasn't so special, that would be okay too, right? The ability to do more idiosyncratic and more complex things is something that allows us, particularly in bubble times, for instance, between, you know, the mid 20 teens and late 21, it allows us to kind of avoid the things that become highly price competitive, and where basically price taking is the norm, and go use that ability to do that which is complex in order to defend our margin, to defend the alpha that we're creating on a return punitive risk basis. And so, you know, that is really, if you really boil down what we do for a living, I would refer to it as kind of deep value investing, whereby we use structure in order to catalyze the kind of realization of value that otherwise, in, for instance, a plain old value stock picking situation, might otherwise be trapped because you're waiting for someone else to recognize the value that you've uncovered.
And then just in terms of, you know, again, sort of the, I guess the check sizes in terms of and how long you're looking to be in positions, is there sort of consistency across the different strategies that you're engaging in or asset classes?
No, it can vary. You know, again, I think the fact that we can do a great number of small things allowed us during the peak bubble times to avoid being price takers. But again, that's a measure of complexity, right? Would I love to do a smaller number of larger things that were obviously superior return for you to risk? Of course. And so over time, you know, as the opportunity set becomes larger, as it becoming now, you know, there's always a balance between, you know, the amount of capital you have at your disposal and the kind of, you know, relevant average sizes. You know, so I would say these days we're probably at 10 to 50 million at a shot. But, you know, there are situations that are much larger that we've done where we brought capital around it. And there are also situations there where we might do an aggregation of lots of smaller bits that might be a few hundred thousand at a time, where the kind of return is kind of highly differentiated. Furthermore, from the perspective of term, we are utterly indifferent to whether something is a day trade versus, you know, a 2-year loan versus owning it for several more years. And so again, it's what we saw during the bubble times was that duration was systematically underpriced. And so, you know, by definition, the longer you're exposed in an investment, the more puts you're short, you know, both idiosyncratic as well as kind of macroeconomic. And so what we saw is people just were plain old not getting paid for that. And so from my perspective, we want to optimize such that we are getting paid on in order to maximize return per unit of risk, per unit of duration, per unit of complexity, per unit of correlation. Across all those vectors to make sure that we're kind of extracting the best returns that we can.
A lot to dive into there, but I guess maybe before I got a couple more, and I know Sam's sort of chomping at the bit to jump in here, but maybe coming back to the sourcing piece real quick, you know, and you alluded to this a little bit in terms of, you know, it being sort of a relationship driven dynamic, but again, I guess given sort of the broad arena of things, in, no pun intended, I guess, of things that you're sort of participating in, is there a standard process? Are you working with sourcing partners or banking relationships, or are there directed relationships? Because it seems to me like you're going to be knocking on a lot of doors when you're writing, you know, $10 or $50 million checks, and you've got a little bit more, I think, than $5 billion in terms of deployed capital.
Yeah. Well, when we do our joint ventures and you know, over time, about 2/3 of our illiquid investments by NAV don't leverage our joint ventures, but about 2/3 by number do. So we tend to aggregate a greater number of smaller bits of collateral through those joint venture structures. But we tend to organize them in three ways. One is that we might have a couple of folks who have an extraordinary amount of experience in an area and might idiosyncratically do, you know, one or two transactions a year where they're willing to, where they're kind of semi or fully independently wealthy and want to put in their own money and kind of exploit their particular expertise as partners with us. The second is situations where folks have an ongoing, what I would call intermediation or maintenance or servicing business of some sort, where they through that they come upon transactions that are particularly compelling that if they only had the money at the time, they'd love to pursue. And they effectively can create those proprietary opportunities through their natural order of business and also are otherwise covering their ongoing kind of expense nut through that intermediation or maintenance or servicing business. And then the third is situations where we can actually create a company that specializes in a particular investment or loan type, where, for instance, there might be the opportunity to kind of co-finance those investments, with a bank in an efficient way, where ultimately we might then be rewarded with by the marketplace by for not only the success of those investments, but also for the creation of intangible value. So, as an example, in the wake of the crisis in 08, I started a an asset-based lending company because banks were kicking small borrowers out, and guys with the receivables and inventory machinery kind of couldn't get their banks to like them anymore. So we did that at pretty favorable rates, and we were able to get a bank to finance us day one. And then over time, as kind of 2015, 16 came around, the investment opportunity was a lot tighter. It was a lot more competitive. Our cost of financing was much lower, but really, at that point, it was much less compelling on an investment by investment basis. So we sold it to a business development company or BDC at 2x book value. So we made great returns on the investments, and we made a great return on the platform, right? That for which we paid nothing. And so those are the three ways we tend to organize those things in order to create, some sort of differentiated sourcing capability based on some sort of unique edge that our partners have.
That's pretty fascinating. I guess maybe before turning over to Sam, I mean, we had talked before and you'd mentioned as sort of the current landscape in terms of what the opportunity is, and you threw out the barbell. So I guess I know what the barbell means at the gym, but I guess in terms of how you're thinking about it for the strategy, I guess what does it mean? How are things progressing according to that framework in terms of how you're looking at the world?
Sure. Well, I think the way I would look at it, and we have looked at it, and it seemed to have played out thus far, is we start from the top. And to be clear, we're not macro people. We don't make investments based on the macroeconomic kind of environment. We want to be inured to that, actually. However, you can't hide from the fact that in 2012 we had QE2, which was basically a really, really questionable judgment to drop rates systematically in order to basically answer a decline in the stock market, which made no sense and was completely not what that was for. And that abuse of the marketplace by not only the United States, but many other of the world's governments created the Titanic asset bubble that has never, that is larger than any bubble that has ever been. And starting, generally in 2020, we saw a tremendous escalation in fiscal indiscipline. And so that means that those two put together are really dangerous because when a government is busy incinerating its currency, the ability of its monetary authority to drop the compensation that it rewards investors globally to expose themselves to that currency, it becomes very difficult. And so what happens is you have a combination of elevated rates and elevated inflation that ultimately mean that cap rates are going to go up in property and multiples are going to go down in assets and companies. And, it's going to be real ugly if you happen to do that during a time when you've had the largest asset bubble that's ever been. And so as a result, you have this asset bubble that is now getting that was popped starting in late 21. And it was popped in everything, right? Across all the across many, many, many different types of assets. The difference was the degree to which those asset areas were exposed for the great value disparities that were created during the bubble. And the way things are exposed is by effectively forcing by being in a situation where assets are forced to be priced. Because one of the great innovations that the financial markets kind of came up with in the post GFC environment was the ability to thwart price discovery. And so the incentives have been overwhelming to avoid pricing your assets accurately. And as Munger used to say, show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome. And so it was completely logical that when that bubble imploded, or began to, the first subject of that was the growth and venture space in late 21, right? Because when you have businesses that actually need money, somebody's got to do it, and they got to do it at a price. And so there's no way to hide, right, in terms of the repricing of those situations. And then in 22, people in the allocators in the fund space generally realized, wow, I'm long a lot of stuff that has a lot longer duration than I ever imagined. And I owe my pensioners, my university students and operations requirements, or my, the various folks that, these allocators need to service, a certain amount of money each year. And given the duration of these assets, I'm going to have to start to sell the assets in order to meet those obligations. And so there beget a gigantic opportunity that has only begun to unfold in the secondary space for collateral that's wrapped in funds. And then in early 23, of course, you had SVB and First Republic. And what happened there was, one, you had the obvious secular changes in office and retail. Two, the fact that the reality of sustained cap rate elevation, meaning that everybody was basically underwater on their loans. And three, the sudden and surprise realization that demand deposits at banks weren't so good anymore, because they could move at the touch of an iPhone. And so this kind of longstanding kind of traditional method by which people thought of bank deposits as being superior to term deposits kind of was turned on its head, and everybody realized the entire banking system was asset liability mismatched. And then you're now seeing on the corporate side, in 23 you had more bankruptcies than you saw since 2010. And again, a lot of great creativity being brought to thwarting price discovery, but the reality is there's an interconnection between CLOs, middle market lending, leverage finance, and middle market private equity. And none of them could have boomed without all the others happening. And so when you suddenly raise rates, it means your AAAs that were funding the wall of leverage finance that came through the CLOs were much more expensive. People realized there was a lot more risk to 10 times levered CLO equity, particularly when you're providing it for someone else who's completely misaligned with you. And so that whole chain started to unwind, and it's happening and slowly happening. And then finally, in structured finance, we saw delinquencies moving up in a lot of different sub areas. And again, a number of the owners of what they call real money, large scale institutions that own those securities, are actually disincentivized to ever sell them, no matter how bad they get, right? Because if they sell, they have to take the loss through their income statement. But if they just take a mark to market, they only have to take it through their balance sheet. And so those are going to continue to unfold. And so to take the long way to answering your question, what this creates is this massive barbell. And on the right side of that barbell are kind of opportunities where you can buy obligations busted, or you can do idiosyncratic funky financings, or all kinds of arrangements that otherwise would be more difficult to do during normal times. And on the left side of the barbell, a whole series of businesses in asset areas that are far more scalable, more homogeneous, more able to kind of be approached in a kind of common way, that were really relatively poor risk reward for quite a while, that have now come back around and become interesting. And so you see us circling back and doing commercial mortgage lending, energy lending, asset-based lending, lower middle market non-sponsored lending, all these things that were really at times at kind of nosebleed levels that made no sense, that were full of price taking, that have now become far more compelling. And those two sides of the barbell are where we spend our time.
So then digging in a little bit, just in terms of, again, those strategies that you all are operating in, specifically the direct lending side of things, what mm-hmm. have you seen just in terms of, overall market right now in direct lending? And more broadly, a lot of popularity in terms of a lot of coverage, a lot of issuance. So what are you seeing on your side in terms of where the market's at right now?
Yeah, I would say, to be clear, even the most generic, quote unquote, direct lending is better than it was 3 or 4 years ago, right? And there have been enormous amounts of fundraisings by folks who appropriately point out that that's a pretty compelling thing directionally. What they forget to note is that they also thought it was really compelling in 2019 when it was terrible. And so, that ultimately those losses will kind of come in the future. And we didn't have any exposure to that, but we would argue that it is interesting today. I would say it's less interesting directionally in the larger scale where the large scale kind of asset gatherers are focused. But I would say, you know, having created one of the top five, what is now called direct lending businesses almost now 20 years ago, you know, at the time, we were lending in the, you know, kind of in the three-ish area for typically 3 years with monthly compensation, monthly covenant testing, no kind of nonsensical EBITDA adjustments, and getting paid, you know, mid-high teens. And so we're back to that now in terms of what we're doing on a day-to-day basis, looking at kind of either non-sponsored or lightly sponsored situations. And we actually created a partnership called Mercatus Finance out of Nashville to kind of go at that, you know, kind of all day long. I would say on the lower middle markets direct, lower middle market sponsored basis, I think that's more like, call it, you know, 11, 12 on a, and again, with a, what they call three-handled create multiple, meaning leveraging, you know, debt to cash flow, true cash flow in the threes. Again, more like three, sometimes a little longer, kind of risk-free plus 550 to 600. And, you know, and that can be a pretty solid business as well, as long as, you know, we kind of, you kind of retain discipline. In a lot of instances, you'll find direct lenders refer to their borrowers as clients or customers, when in fact, our limited partners are our customers, and the borrowers are our counterparties. And so, unfortunately, again, you know, incentive and outcome, you know, people started to forget that a little bit. And, you know, you saw tremendous amounts of amend, extend, and pretend activity that, you know, are ongoing, particularly on the corporate side relative to versus real estate. And so, yes, I think it is, it's a great opportunity directionally now. In some sub areas more than others, in some countries more than others. But a number of the largest purveyors of that were also up to loaded up to their eyeballs at exactly the wrong time in a lot of ugly stuff that still has to kind of get worked out.
And then I guess with that, looking at where you all operate in the direct lending space, it looks like it's pretty diverse, kind of similar to the strategies that you all are operating in as well. What are you seeing at the sector level? Are there particular areas of concern for you all right now, areas that you might be avoiding? And I guess vice versa, where are you seeing some opportunities for growth there too?
Well, if by direct lending, just to be clear, we're talking about corporate and we can be make it simple and talk about North America, I would say we're certainly most interested in, from a left side of the barbell perspective, most interested in asset-based lending. Again, non-sponsored lending. We're very interested in energy lending because there are a lot of non-economic reasons people kind of avoid that area and think there's a lot of opportunities. I would say right side of the barbell as well, there's a lot of opportunity in what otherwise would be great businesses, right? Because there's actually an inverse correlation between business quality and the degree to which they might be exposed to problems, because the best businesses were most appealing to private equity. Had the highest cash flow conversion, were least asset dependent, but also borrowed the most, right? And so you see otherwise great businesses in enterprise software or healthcare services, business services, where there's real five forces advantage, where there's just was way too much debt, right? And so ultimately that has to get rationalized in some way. And that provides what we would call right side of the barbell opportunities to kind of, you know, be involved in a restructuring of some sort. And as well, you know, new left side of the barbell opportunities where sellers are now ready to accept much lower prices. And by the way, it's still super early for that. And you can do the new issue lending at appropriate levels with appropriate compensation that, you know, now makes sense again in a post-bubble popping environment.
I did want to kind of maybe pull on one of the threads that you mentioned, because you've mentioned it now a couple of times in terms of the non-sponsor dynamic in terms of where you're choosing to do your lending, which is actually, you know, kind of in juxtaposition to what you hear a lot of people say that are in the space, that they really prefer those sort of sponsor-led deals for whatever the reasons are in terms of the ability for them to throw in more capital. Is there a driver there in terms of why you prefer to sort of not be engaged on the other side of sponsors?
Well, they're really smart and really sophisticated, and they don't care about our outcome. I'm not sure why they'd be preferred. You know, ultimately, the sponsor lending business, as it kind of is currently constituted, traces its origins back to the mid '80s with a company called Heller Financial that was bought by GE, and they had this thing called the Heller Term C, where they would go out 7 years at a little more leverage than the banks would, and charge, you know, a little bit more. And they derived such great, wonderful comfort because the private equity sponsors were so talented and so capable and cared about them so much that if things went sideways, they would kind of plow more and more of their investors' money in no matter what in order to protect them, except that that never, ever happened. And so, you know, I've had many experiences, unfortunately, with sponsors where when the value of the enterprise decreased, but the lender's loan was still in the money and the equity was severely impaired, unfortunately, there have been instances where sponsors were willing to basically risk the kind of asset coverage of the creditor in order to increase the value of his or her out of the money call option in very potentially destructive ways. And so that led me to think, gee whiz, they don't have our best interest at heart sometimes. In the case of non-sponsored businesses, not necessarily that that wouldn't be the case, but we have found that while there might be less sophistication in certain instances, and we might have to do things like say, hey, it's time to get off QuickBooks now, you know, and put in real, you know, real controls and have a real auditor and do things in an appropriate way and potentially even have objective and key results and the right kind of reporting. That can be preferable at times to folks who have it all buttoned up, but, you know, are kind of not as focused on you, the outcome of their creditors.
So I guess with that then to in the due diligence process for you all, are there certain criteria that in your eyes like have to be met when, you know, you're looking into a specific deal? I mean, I would think maybe particularly participating in club deals, or maybe you want to always be the relationship lender. Is there a certain criteria that you're looking for in these deals?
Well, I would say I've never been a big club deal person. We've had some unfortunate scenarios where folks who were less focused on kind of the ultimate recovery value of their of the kind of lending assets, you know, mixed with those who were more focused on that. And, you know, we've encountered folks who are very uncomfortable taking over enterprises, and, you know, don't feel like they can do it, don't want to do it. We've had folks who, you know, realize they have an impairment or potential risk of it, but, you know, don't want to necessarily upset the sponsor or get, quote unquote, get a reputation among the sponsors, you know, because for, you know, for doing what I would argue is the right thing for their investors. So when we have partnered a great number of times, but typically with people who really have a mindset similar to ours, where you know, we know what we're trying to get accomplished, and so and can and actually in that instance we benefit from a second pair of eyes and the greater diversity that comes from, you know, working with other smart people who kind of you know, again, share our perspective on things. With regard to the, you know, the types of loans within the, again, the direct lending space, it's pretty basic. It's highly free cash regenerative Buffett style moated franchises that in addition can handle turbulence, right? Because if things go sideways and a business kind of can't handle going through an amendment or a default process or go through a, or can't handle going through a bankruptcy, it means that basically you're taking fundamentally the same risk as the equity guy, you're just not getting paid. And you have a lot of risk that you might be taking advantage of when things go bad. And so, as an example, we wouldn't lend to an advertising agency, right? That might be gushing free cash flow. But if there's a hiccup, they say, well, you know, if you don't amend or cheapen my, you know, your coupon or change your covenants, we're going to all go out the elevator and leave you with nothing, right? And so that you have to be very careful in those instances. And then separately, the other kind of thing we'd look at is just assets, lending against assets that retain their value, that are not just a big hunk of metal, right? But something where there's a near-term path to deriving cash flow from that asset, right? And that can be great too. And in that instance, we might be more tolerant of a wider type of entrepreneur owner because we don't really need that person to, you know, because the asset's the asset. And so, you know, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, again, we get to make a disproportionate return for unit of risk because it's a, you know, an interesting asset, a less experienced owner, operator, equity provider. Speed is necessary. It's an out of favor area or things of that sort. There's always some process related reason why we get to make kind of extra in when we do these more kind of special situation and now what I would call right side of the barbell oriented things.
So transitioning slightly, but I guess still related to the point you're making there at the end around asset specific deals, the world of structured credit, how are you seeing current conditions right now? Are there certain areas where you're a little weary or do you think, you know, right now it's solid and there could be some potential down the road?
I think there's a bunch of areas that are interesting. And to be clear, and there's no magic about these terms, I would think of it as structured finance, which I differentiate from structured credit being more using, applying structured finance to corporate credit, whereas the broader structured finance is really things that are kind of applicable or could be applicable to rediscount financing or securitization in some form. And so within that broader structured finance universe, as an example, aviation is less interesting because there's a lot more demand because, you know, the Boeing stuff and other issues have created, a much more benign environment. On the other side, you know, subprime auto is really interesting because it was really about to implode right before COVID. And then the circumstances of COVID created a kind of positive perfect storm for subprime auto. So it ballooned. And so now it's incredibly exposed to kind of consumer delinquencies and oversupply and provide some real opportunities on the right side of the barbell to kind of go at kind of distress and special situation opportunities that are going to be super compelling. Things like leasing that have been kind of substantially overdone and are encountering some issues in a lot of different kind of sub equipment areas. And they're more new areas that have provided opportunity within the securitized markets, things like various forms of royalties, music and otherwise, a whole lot of other more idiosyncratic areas that used to be the purview of banks that have now become kind of more, privately done. So lots of opportunities.
I guess maybe changing gears a little bit and kind of moving into real estate, because I know that's something that's near and dear to your heart. Kind of a crazy world today. I think you kind of alluded to it again in terms of some of this stuff's been sort of slow to move through the proverbial python here. But I guess, maybe stepping back and sort of more macro level, sort of what happened there? And I guess, you know, in terms of where's the market today? What kind of new issue lending environment do we have? And then I guess maybe digging into geographics, whether, you know, it's U.S. or Europe or otherwise, kind of where's the opportunity set?
Sure. Well, what happened there was in the wake of the crisis, particularly in North America, but a lot of times in Europe, too, banks were told, you're pretty terrible at most things you do. So just buy securities and lend to real estate.
So they must be married.
And keep your nose clean. Yeah, exactly. And so what the banks did is they bought a ton of securities at exactly the wrong time and exposed themselves to tremendous duration risk, and they systematically overlent to real estate. And that was exactly what they were told to do. And the government, of course, you know, forgets that. And now they, you know, they've created the problems that they have both on the security side as well as the CRE side. And so in the United States, what that means is, that there's a lot of really bad and mismarked assets there. But the government has said, well, by the way, why don't you take it easy on those borrowers, you know, ease your way through and, you know, maybe pray for lower rates that, you know, might happen, even though maybe they won't. And let's see what happens, because ultimately what's best for the regulators is for banks to make a 0.001% ROE, right? So as long as they don't blow themselves up or take any risk, that is ideal. From the perspective of the government, which effectively wants them to serve as utilities. And so what that means is that the right side of the barbell opportunities haven't presented themselves yet, because the banks, in their interest, given that they need to effectively report earnings, haven't built up enough earnings to allow them to build up enough reserves to allow them to take the losses that they've actually already incurred. And so we, in our partnerships with people who buy busted bank loans every day, have found that, for instance, workout departments are not receiving files because if a bank moves the file from kind of performing to workout, it means there's an appraisal done, which means they have to report what the appraisal says, which is not going to be good. And so it's going to take several quarters for banks to build up reserves such that they can start to actually recognize the losses they've already incurred. And the losses are enormous. And so, you know, we're going to be all over that. And we continue to, you know, selectively buy busted loans here and there as we go. And we've also seen banks basically say, can we sell you less impaired stuff where the hit is going to be lower, that it might allow us to kind of get some more liquidity, because we're still facing pressure in terms of our liquidity versus our solvency because of the kind of instability of our deposits. And so those are also opportunities that we're seeing. The major opportunity on the real estate side from our perspective is really the left side of the barbell, which is new issue loans. Because basically, if you borrowed within the last 5 or 6 years, and you're showing up with a loan that's maturing, you're going to need 20 points of equity just to kind of stay in your property. And a lot of folks can't do that. And so the opportunity to is basically such that 3 years ago, people were lending at 5 or 6% on five-year transactions at 80% loan to value on assets valued at a 5 cap, i.e. 20 times their NOI. And so that's become now lending 65 or 70% against a 7 or 8 cap asset in a 2-year transaction and making 12 or 13. That's really interesting. And so I think there's kind of billions of that to do, and we'd like to do it.
So I guess that maybe kind of actually, and maybe this ends up being a little bit of a soapbox question if I'm sort of anticipating the vibe correctly here, but you know, the CRE piece, along with what you'd mentioned about CLOs, and we hear it obviously about the private credit space as well, and when you start thinking about certain vintages that have come through the market, and a lot of this paper that people are just sort of crossing their fingers, doing that extend and pretend behavior, hoping that rates come down so that they can kind of get the cap structure right-sized or affordable again. And right now, people are willing to sort of absorb that because they see, or at least had seen, the Fed is sort of being ready to sort of jump in and maybe throw out a little bit of a lifeline there. How bad, I mean, when we start rolling up those different market aspects, you know, whether you're talking loans to the CLOs, as we noted, you know, CREs and private credit and whatever else is out there, how big of sort of a weight is that sort of on the chest of the market, do you think, over sort of the intermediate term?
It's enormous. Again, because you have the greatest bubble that's ever been, and it takes, you know, what ultimately is going to happen is what's in the personal best interests of the people who run governments and run monetary authorities. And that answer, and that is to keep a combination of rates and inflation high. And part of the reason why there's a lot of jawboning about dropping rates without dropping rates happening, separate from the kind of, you know, desire to affect elections, is that effectively, you know, no one wants to see someone drop rates and see inflation, you know, spark up, because you know, making it clear to the global markets that, in fact, this combination of elevated rates and inflation is going to be the new normal, which I believe it will be, is not something people want to hear, because they want to keep the hope alive. And so it's just going to take a while. Look, I mean, we're buying in Southern Europe, we're still buying busted loans that have been kind of impaired and distressed since the last GFC. It takes a long time for a lot of these things to kind of work their way through the you know, digestive system of the financial markets.
So changing topics here a little bit, just turning to the world of venture lending and growth credit, can you first just walk us through your definition of those specific areas just so that our listeners are on the same page, and then how you've seen the market over the past 5+ years or so?
Sure. So venture lending is certainly not one thing, and that is venture capital. Right. And so the idea that it's great to lend to venture backed companies and take venture capital style risk, but make a capped return, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And if you did that, you're going to go out of business quickly. And so I first got into that in the wake of the implosion of the thing called Comdisco, which was an enormous venture lessor and venture lender that started taking a lot of venture capital risk and blew itself up. And so we were buying some of its existing obligations and loans at very favorable levels. And I discovered there's this kind of thing that seemed kind of interesting, where intuitively in growth companies, there were situations where, for instance, some sort of asset value or recurring cash flow base had been created, but the equity really desired the opportunity to take their what otherwise would be the cash flow for the business and invest it in growth. And so, and theoretically, if you stop that growth, you would then again have a franchise or a series of cash flows that represented something appropriate for a debt style risk. And you could effectively advance against that value at a kind of teens plus equity upside type of level. And that could be compelling. And it was compelling at times on an non-cyclical basis. So in the wake of the implosion of tech 1.0, it was compelling. And then by 06 and 07, less compelling. And then, you know, we kind of came back. And at that point, we had started two successful now public venture lenders and effectively divested ourselves at that time. We came back to it in 2015. It was still crazy. It didn't make sense. But now in the last couple of years, it's become much more compelling because the seed and Series A and Series B valuations are much more compressed. And so the bar to get funding at all is much higher. They're much better businesses. They're people actually thinking about cash flow who have learned that you can't eat revenue. And so there are real opportunities on what I would call the left side of the barbell in new issue venture lending. Growth credit, I would contrast, and people, again, use their own definitions for these things, but I would argue that because of this gigantic kind of venture capital bubble where people feasted on negative cost equity for a period of years, there were certain large-scale enterprises that have created real franchise value or ubiquity that's monetizable, that makes a lot of sense. It's just not worth anywhere near where their venture capitalists had provided them capital. And in a lot of those instances where, you know, people, venture capital backed companies, their last round was 2 or 4 or 6 or 10 billion. Maybe those enterprises and equity values are now 20% of that. And again, there's a desire not to necessarily recognize that. And so there's a willingness to borrow, call it 10 or 15% of value and pay kind of 20 plus type percent returns on the theory that, you know, they'll continue to grow. Ultimately, the markets will open, you know, rates will come down, private equity will be more available, et cetera, and they'll kind of live to fight another day without deluding themselves. And that's, you know, with a T, not a D, in terms of their equity value, and ultimately allow them to triumph despite the very high valuations at which they invested their capital.
And then I wanted to turn back to something you'd mentioned at the beginning around you building out the IT side at Arena. You said you've been working on that since 2004. How does that innovation and technology factor into the overall investment process at Arena?
Yeah, it's critical. And again, my colleagues would say, well, what were you working on? So I was aware of it and a fan of it and helped hopefully design it. But I don't know that I coded it. I'm certain I didn't code it. But we had a lot of people and a lot of kind of sub vendors working on that for many years and continue to do so. And the idea there is that, you know, no one had really made an enterprise software system for a global chaser of illiquidity, and the variability of the things that we're invested in create problems when you're thinking about the homogeneity that you would prefer when thinking through the kind of creation of an enterprise system. And so therefore there was nothing available on the shelf. And so we started to kind of create it ourselves. And that's a really kind of an end-to-end thing. There's a lot of underlying machinery that allows what otherwise would be a great variety of transaction types to be kind of handled in a scalable way. And so it's been really important for us in order to kind of create a what we think of as almost like an assembly line type of approach to the kind of manufacture of these situations to kind of organize it and run it all through our system. So every transaction we do kind of passes through kind of 10 stages, all of which are on the system. And you think about all the documents you have to keep with regard to those things, all the data you have to maintain, you know, who's wiring who, when, all the reconciliations you have to go through, all the audits you have to process. It just gets to be a lot. And so, and in fact, we've had people offer to be kind of beta sites insofar as we might want to at some point prefer to, you know, think about, you know, providing that for other people in addition to the other things that we do for other people in our business. And so, it is a really vital thing that lives and breathes and is interconnected with our servicing operation, which is based in Jacksonville and where the largest office is in Bengaluru.
So I want to stay mindful of time here, so maybe just a couple more questions. And I think one that always I love to ask with people that are founders of businesses is sort of the cultural aspect, right? And I think, you know, with Arena in particular, it seems particularly acute just given, again, just how the model is run, you know, the combination of sort of the in-house employees as well as sort of the partnerships that you develop and stuff like that. So I guess, how do you think about sort of the culture that you've tried to create for Arena, and how does that sort of impact or influence the success of the firm at all?
Well, you know, I've kind of started, I created my first business almost 25 years ago. And I've spent the vast majority of my career as kind of an entrepreneur at the same time as being an investor. And I've always been a fan of a, what I would think of as a relatively low key type of culture that just rewards people who have, you know, very, who have big brains, who want to work a lot, and are kind of, you know, extremely, extremely curious. And we want to minimize kind of big personality cult type stuff, and, you know, as much as possible. And certainly these firms tend to be a function of one or two or three people and earlier in their life, but we aspire to create a franchise not dependent on any one person, that such that we create real intangible value in the enterprise. And so that's part of that culture kind of feeds into that goal. And then also, you know, there's a lot of folks in our business with, you know, kind of, you know, Wall Street, fixed income, mortgagey type backgrounds where there, you know, historically has been some, you know, aggressive internal behavior. And I never came from any of that. The only time I spent in an investment bank was in mergers, and they just kind of worked the heck out of us, but it wasn't necessarily the kind of, you know, liar's poker type of environment. And so we don't really like any of that kind of stuff. We don't like yelling and screaming. There's no yelling and screaming required amongst colleagues. And so, you know, I would say it's a kind of work a day, you know, bring your proverbial briefcase in, take care of your business, and, you know, be friendly and pleasant to folks, because life is too short, you know, for us to kind of work with folks who are not. And, you know, hopefully people like that kind of feeling. And also one that rewards, you know, people being intellectually curious about the different things that we invest in from our investment folks' perspective, so that nothing is off the table just because there's some kind of arbitrary rule that you don't do X.
Fantastic. Well, I guess with that, this has been the great global chase of illiquidity. So Dan, on behalf of Sam and myself, thanks so much for joining us today. You know, certainly the credit equivalent of maybe riding a small world at the Magic Kingdom, I think. But so really appreciate you taking us on the tour there. To our listeners, thanks again once, as always, for joining us. Please do be sure to follow, comment, and share. Once again, this has been Credit Crunch.